Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. It's our Friday Week in Review segment, and we're going to start today with the tragic shooting deaths this week of five people in the greater Boston area. Three of the shootings happened in Boston, and Mayor Marty Walsh said enough is enough.
This needs to stop. These press conferences need to stop. We need to make sure that when we have press conferences, we're announcing something good. We're not announcing where I have to start out by saying to the family, my condolences are with you for the loss of your loved ones.
Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans says the shootings were likely gang-related, and he says while homicides in the city are down compared with last year this time, gun violence is up.
For the year, we're only up 10 instances, but overall, we're up 34 shootings.
So what can be done to bring down gun violence? Does this spate of violence say anything about city leadership? These are among the questions that we're going to ask our Week in Review panel. John Carroll, who's a professor of communication at Boston University and a WBUR senior analyst, is with us. John, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus and a political consultant. Welcome.
Thank you.
So let's start with this violence in Greater Boston. As we said, three of these shootings were in Boston Wednesday, one in Everett, one in Cambridge. John, your reaction? This a summertime annual event for the most part, or does this say have some kind of message here?
This is so depressingly repetitive, and Marty Walsh comes out and says, this has to stop. Marty Walsh has had exactly the same press conference two or three times now. Mm. So, you know, it's difficult. The police commissioner, William Evans, said, I'm not sure what more we can do. At this point, in terms of community policing, I think this is gangs and guns, and those are the two things that that need to be addressed. This is not, by the way, unique to Boston. In New York last weekend, there were 22 shootings over the weekend with three fatalities. And then on Monday, there were five more shootings. Mm. So this is something that's happening in a lot of different urban areas. And I think a lot of really good, smart people have yet to come up with a solution for this.
Mm. Well, let's go back to the gang point of what you're saying, because the city is deploying street workers. And those are people who reach out to young people in an effort to prevent violence. And yesterday, we spoke with Sean Webb, who's with the Boston Centers for Youth and Families. And let's listen to what he said.
We're connected to the top 45 active gangs in the city of Boston.
Can I say, Sean, that sounds like a high number? I think people would be surprised. There are 45 gangs in Boston?
Well, we work with the top 45 most active gangs. We're in 19 housing developments across the city.
45 active gangs. I mean, now we had the Boston Miracle here in the 90s, where we supposedly turned everything around and we were able to make a dent in gang participation and violence. So has something deteriorated here or what? John?
I think that it's hard to keep track of. There are all kinds of connections here. There's money, there's the economy, there's drugs. This is an environment that sort of fosters this kind of illegal activity. And I think that one of the most depressing things I saw was one police official said, there's no code anymore, there's no honor. So if a gang was going out to shoot somebody and that person was walking with the mother or the wife or the kid, they wouldn't shoot. Now they do. And that's why there are so many so much collateral damage at this point because of that sort of lack of any kind of restraint.
Arlene Isaacson, what do you think this says, the violence? Does it say something about city leadership? Does it say something about where Boston is going or what?
No, I actually don't. I think this mayor, I know that this mayor is as committed to solving this problem as the previous one was, and it's heartbreaking for the families involved. It's terrifying for the communities affected, but of course there really is no silver bullet there. There are indirect solutions like working for better jobs, better education, better economic equality, better addiction services, but then there's the direct ones that have to be dealt with, and as the mayor and as Evans have said, the police need help, but that requires confidence in the police force and relationships with the community, both of which I know this administration has been working on, but they're going to have to do even more.
And the mayor also mentioned the gun buyback program and said we need people to participate. Does that really do anything?
The more you get guns off the street, the fewer there are to be engaged in this kind of violence. But, of course, without a federal gun law, which is nowhere likely to be happening right now, someone can go to an adjacent state and pick up whatever the heck they want for gun violence.
Can I just add one thing here? Yeah. The gun buyback program this year has netted exactly one gun. Last year, it was 400. The Boston Herald reported this today, or yesterday, I believe. One gun has been produced by the gun buyback program. So I think that that's not really the solution here. I think something else needs to be done, because that apparently is no longer reaping the benefits it used to reap.
You know, we're going to talk about development in Boston in just a couple of minutes. And, of course, we've heard all of these stories about how expensive it is. And it's getting increasingly expensive, not just in Boston, but in the surrounding areas, to live, to buy commercial real estate. We've had a record commercial real estate purchase in the city as well. So I'm wondering, when something like this happens and it has possible economic effects, when violence like this happens and it has possible economic effects, could that affect either the economy, or could it make city leaders be more likely to act because it may affect the economy? Thoughts?
I think it depends on the neighborhood in which it happens, but you're absolutely right. I have some friends who told me very recently they had moved to a beautiful new home in Dorchester, and when a few weeks ago they found a bullet hole in their bedroom closet, they said, "We're out of here." So some people will tolerate it because they don't have a choice. Some people will tolerate it because it's their neighborhood and where they've always been, and others will just say, "I'm out of here."
Mm. Part of the problem is Boston's a very balkanized city, and there's no real connection between the more upscale neighborhoods and the more working-class urban neighborhoods. So what you have is you have a situation where people are insulated from what's going on in their own community. And so it doesn't affect them. It doesn't concern them. And so you don't have a united effort to try to do something about this.
All right. Well, we're going to have to shift gears a little bit. We're going to talk about recording police. Videos and cell phone shots of police encounters and police shootings have been all over the news for the past year, especially since Ferguson, Missouri, last year. And here in Boston, Police Commissioner Evans told the Boston Herald that he would support some regulation on citizens being able to record the police. This is what he had to say. Let's listen.
If we can get legislation to make it fair so it protects both sides, then I'm all for it. You know, should you be up in a police officer's face agitating them? Absolutely not. Would I love to see, a little distance? I'd love to see that.
Arlene Isaacson, how about that legislation, making sure that there is space between citizens who try to record police and police officers?
Well, I think it's a bit unrealistic. There's a 30,000-foot view of this issue, and then there's the micro view. The micro view is that if someone is interfering in an officer when they're performing their duty, whether it's with a camera or any other fashion, that's illegal. That's a law issue. But the nature of, because of cell phone videos that have been in the news over the past year, it's really changed the nature of the debate, and particularly I think it's changed it for white people and for people of privilege who haven't had to deal with some of these issues. Now, most cops are good, but there is a cultural shift sweeping the country where I think white people and people of privilege in particular can no longer delude themselves about what goes on anymore. It's sort of disconcerting to them to see evidence of how wrong some of their assumptions have been about who are the good guys and who are not. So citizens have the right to videotape the police in the course of doing their job, and it is unavoidable. It's the new world. There is no unringing that bell now. And not all the police, of course, are doing intentional bias. Some of them is what you might describe as unintentional. It's sort of culturally driven. They're not even aware of it. Evans can't expect that that's not going to move forward and continue to happen. The question is whether or not the police will be handling things correctly. And recently, a few months ago, the ACLU, for example, put out a report about the Boston Police Department. The Boston Police Department does a lot right, particularly under this mayor. But the report showed that there's trouble in River City, that there's disparate treatment from the police department, particularly in communities, Black and Latino communities. And that existed not just under this mayor. The report was about the previous one. So the problem is this. If you don't change the policy, there's no reason to believe that those actions don't continue.
Right.
and cameras allow people to see whether those actions are continuing.
And the interesting thing about that report was that it was released a while ago by the ACLU, and the Boston police said, well, that's an old report, and then the Boston police confirmed it and released it on the 4th of July. So it was sort of an interesting way of dealing with it. John Carroll, I'm wondering what you think about this whole notion of perhaps giving police more space before citizens would be allowed to record them and use technology.
You know, between the police body cams and the civilian cell cams, this is turning into some sort of M.C. Escher drawing. you know, everybody's videotaping everything. I think the regulation part is interesting, but sort of perilous in many ways. Berkeley Police Department just changed its regulations to say that the police should minimize the restrictions on public observers and also should keep them at a safe distance. There's a lot of discretion built into that language. Mm. And people think, civil liberties people think, that's purposeful so that it gives police greater powers. It was interesting. Commissioner Evans, in that interview, had to use the word irritating three or four times.
And agitating, right.
And that's part of the problem, is that this can escalate situations in ways that make them more dangerous for everybody involved. So I think that if you could count on people's common sense, that would be great. But if you live in the real world, that's probably not something you want to take to the bank.
And it's one of the reasons that the importance of body cams, police wearing body cams, would help enormously. There are the 25 largest cities in this country have already moved in that direction, so it's inevitable that it's going to happen, and in fact should happen here in Massachusetts. I think that the mayor and the commissioner, while they're cautious, I think they really need to come around on that, because you can't fix a problem if you don't know it exists. And what we're finding around the country is that there are fewer problems when people know they're being recorded, both a perpetrator of the crime who knows they're being recorded and the police who know it as well. But the key is to have privacy protections associated with it, because you want the police to have the body cams, but you want to make sure that people's First Amendment, their privacy rights are protected. And again, the ACLU, working with community groups, has put together a really good template on how to reach that balance.
Well, speaking of that, Commissioner Evans was on our show, and we actually, of course, asked him about body cameras, and he says he's waiting to decide. He has several concerns. He's worried that perhaps if folks were recorded, it could hamper police officers' ability to do their job. Maybe somebody who thought they were giving confidential information might be reluctant to come forward with information if they thought they were always being recorded, and what might happen with that. And he said it could also harm trust. But this is also what he told us. Let's listen.
What's disturbing to me is we're paying for the sins of what's happened across the country. Those disturb me, they disturb our officers, but that's not what we're about here. And I can see why everyone is craving for these, but let's go in at it slow, methodical. Let's not go in and jump and spend all kinds of money till we see the results.
That's Boston Police Commissioner Evans about this notion of body cameras. He's urging a cautious approach. And at the same time this week, we heard from Senate President Stan Rosenberg, who said he supports creating a state grant program for police departments to try out the use of body cameras. Now, we haven't heard from House Speaker DeLeo or Governor Baker about this. They're not commenting. Why does it appear that Massachusetts is proceeding with so much caution here? I mean, is it... We haven't had a crisis, so there's no big push, right? We haven't had a big high-profile incident involving our police officers, or do we have very strong law enforcement unions here that's making everyone be quiet?
You know, I think that there's a little bit of a delusion going on. You know, we like to think we're the North, not the South. We're the progressives, not the, you know, we're not the Confederate flag holders in this state. But the fact of the matter is, again, based in part on the report that was put out by the ACLU and based on common sense, we're hearing more and more examples of problems that are happening. They may not all be in Boston. One in Medford, one in Chelsea, mm-hmm. where there are police that have been on videotapes acting inappropriately. So the importance of what Stan Rosenberg, the Senate president, did this week is by saying, hey, I'm willing to put some state money on this to run some pilot programs. Let's not sit and think endlessly about it when so many other states are moving forward on it. Let's do some test runs here in Massachusetts and see what works or not, and figure out ways of balancing privacy and Fourth Amendment protections and due process protections with the important right of the public to know what's going on.
And let's not forget that videos aren't the ultimate truth all the time. I mean, there's what happened before, there's what happened after. Every video is edited by its very nature. So to use these as the ultimate arbiter of reality is, I think, overemphasizing the usefulness of these body cams and the usefulness of civilian cams, too.
Right, right. Well, so, okay, we're going to try to get a couple more topics in here. We've got a development in the Boston area this week. The Boston Redevelopment Authority just last night approved 8 new building projects in the city, including a proposed apartment building by North Station that would rent at below market rates. Then, of course, Cambridge. We keep hearing about development in Cambridge. There's a plan to rezone part of Kendall Square to allow more growth there while guaranteeing affordable housing, according to everyone involved. So we did part of our show on this topic this week, and we had a call from Peter. He says he's a resident of Cambridge, and he mentioned what the development of the West End and the end of rent control and this growth in Kendall Square means to low-income families. Let's listen.
Think a moment how the poor in projects must feel with all of this rising like a big wave alongside them. You know, that's just despicable. I'm moving to the North Country in northwestern Massachusetts to simply get away from it.
And he, of course, said that he lived in the area for for decades, actually. So affordable housing is an issue. We heard from Peter and a lot of other callers during our show. How is the city, is Greater Boston going to stay affordable when you've got all this development going on? And, of course, there are city leaders saying we need this development. We need it for the economy. Do you see that there's real danger here, John Carroll?
Absolutely. If you remember Marty Walsh's campaign for mayor when he ran, 2 years ago, was very much about two Bostons and the concern that that we're splitting into two, you know, the haves and the have-nots. There are 70 projects in the works right now in Boston. I think it's $4 billion worth of development. There is a pittance of it that's dedicated to affordable housing. So I think what's happening here is a building boom that we have probably never seen before. And it's no accident that it comes under a new mayor because the BRA was extremely selective previous to Mayor Walsh taking office. So I think that, you know, from an economic standpoint, this is good for a lot of people, but it's not good for most people. And I think that somehow there has to be a way to spread the wealth around a little bit so that people can still afford to live in Boston, because otherwise you're going to have a situation that's very much like New York, which is almost entirely unaffordable in a lot of different areas. And that's not good for the community. That's not good for the health of the city.
Well, you know, tax breaks for developers in downtown Boston for office buildings once made sense once upon a time several decades ago, although you could argue that the development that we've experienced in downtown might have happened anyway because it happened across the country and all the other cities as well that weren't giving these tax breaks to developers. But now things are different. The incentives are no longer needed. It's clear that the mayor cares about affordable housing, and there doesn't seem to be a need for subsidies for office buildings in the downtown any longer. The Beale example that you're referencing is a terrific example of a desperately needed affordable housing in an area of the city where practically none exists anymore. But the key to this is really not just providing for affordable housing, but having the BRA be transparent in what it's doing.
And the BRA is a troubled agency, right?
Exactly.
I mean, we've been reading about big troubles at the BRA that have been going on for a long time, apparently.
And I do disagree with one thing that John said, which made it sound like this was happening under the Walsh administration and not under the Menino administration, but most of the development we're dealing with and we're seeing now, in fact, happen under Mayor Menino. Mm-hmm. So now Walsh has a chance to begin to turn that a little bit and move it more towards affordability.
Well, in that same line of affordability, during our show that we did on development, we spoke with Tom Andrews, and he's the executive vice president of Alexandria Real Estate Equities, and that's a company that has a large footprint in Kendall Square. And we asked him about Cambridge's plan to triple the fees that a developer would pay to put into a fund to pay for affordable housing. So the plan in Cambridge is right now, I think it's like $4 a square foot. It would go up to $12 a square foot, and that money would be used to preserve and buy affordable housing so people could afford, presumably, to live in the Kendall Square neighborhood. Well, he says his company provides parks and new sidewalks and cycle tracks, and increased affordable housing fees could cut into those other perks. Let's listen.
If our affordable housing fees were very much higher, or our affordable housing requirement was very much higher, then some of the other benefits that we were able to provide as part of the development, you know, might not have been feasible. So I think the city has to look at it in a balanced fashion.
So is it really a feasible option for communities like Cambridge and Boston to ask developers for more money for affordable housing, or is this not really going to fly?
I think that, you know, this is holding the public hostage to preserve corporate profits. And I think that that essentially this is a dodge to avoid addressing the question and basically throw it back to the public and say, well, which one do you want? Do you want affordable housing or do you want public spaces that that accommodate the entire community? And I think that that's a Hobson's choice. That's not really the way we should be approaching it. There should be a way to get both of them. And I think that developers are doing just fine. I don't have a lot of sympathy for them coming up short in the profit department. So I think that, you know, this is sort of a way to avoid the issue as opposed to a way to address it.
But at the same time, you can't scare away developers.
No, you don't want to. But mm-hmm. but there are so many advantages for them developing in this area now in terms of life sciences, in terms of the boom in the local economy, that I think that that this is not really a choice that has to be made this way.
And I don't think that they really will be scared off, because if there's money to be made, they'll be there and they'll figure out a way of making it happen, even if it's not quite as much as they had originally wanted. The other thing I hope they pay attention to is what the look and the appearance and the feel and the livability is of these new areas and these new buildings. You know, we've read a lot about in the Seaport District how the size of the buildings and the styles and the landscaping are such that it's creating it's making it a less livable, warm environment. And we're starting to see the same thing in the Fenway development area. And so hopefully we don't want Boston turning into any city USA. It has some architecturally unique characteristics that hopefully they'll respect going forward.
I just want to touch very briefly on a big story this week, and that was the story about putting price caps on pharmaceutical drugs. Under this proposal, the state's Health Policy Commission would require companies to disclose their spending on certain drugs to justify their high prices. Again, this is something that's coming forward and could potentially affect the biotechnology industry, which is a big economic driver in our state. Thoughts on that, John Carroll?
This one will give you a migraine, this debate, because basically you've got two sides that are presenting radically opposite pictures of the healthcare picture.
Right.
So, you know, you have the people who are in favor of price control saying that drug prices are the fastest growing part of healthcare spending. You've got people on the other side who are saying it's 10% of healthcare spending. It's been 10% of healthcare spending for 55 years now. So the first thing that would be good is if the public could get some kind of figures and statistics that they could agree on and rely upon. The other is, you know, there is a legitimate concern that this would dampen research and development of drugs. I mean, the estimate is that it costs $2.6 billion over 10 years to bring a new drug to market, and only 12% of them that go into clinical trials actually get approved by the FDA. So this is a high-risk game that I think the public deserves some honest information on before they start lining up one side or another.
Okay. You know, I view this as a battle between Goliath and Goliath. It's the pharma industry versus the insurance industry. Both of them make lots of money. Both of them spend lots of money on marketing, on CEO salaries and perks, which are off the charts. And the patients are the ones who are the victims. So the way I think about it is this way. Our tax dollars are paying for a lot of these drugs. They're paying it through federal monies for NIH, through tax subsidies, through what we pay into Medicare and Medicaid. If they want to use tax dollars, they got to disclose what they're spending the money on, because we have the right to know, are we paying for TV ads and CEO salaries, or are we paying for the meds?
Okay, very, very briefly now, we have to go to our hubbubs. Let's end with them. We don't have to, but they're fun. These are stories that might not have made the top of the news, but they caught our attention, Arlene.
Well, there are two GLBT-related issues that came up this week in other states that highlight these, the proud role, if you will, that Massachusetts has played on same-sex marriage-related issues. In Kentucky, there are town clerks who are refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, claiming it's against their religious beliefs, even though they issue marriage licenses to all sorts of other couples who don't follow their religious beliefs. Now, Massachusetts was the first state in the nation to defeat DOMA and the first state to have same-sex marriage. So there were plenty of people here in our state at the time who didn't approve of same-sex marriages, and guess what? They and their churches weren't forced to perform them. But public officials have to follow the law, and if they can't follow them in Kentucky, they should find another job. Then in Florida, hospitals are refusing to put on birth certificates the names of both parents if they have same-sex couples. And so to Florida, I say, get over it.
Okay. Sorry, John Carroll. We are out of time. We will have to take your hubbub another time. John Carroll is professor of communication at Boston University and a WBUR senior analyst. Arlene Isaacson is co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus and a political consultant. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.